Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You know, let's add to the debate over whether or not Donald Trump plays four-dimensional chess, whether or not he is this great strategic mind. He spent the last several days attacking John Bolton's book and sicking Bill Barr and the Justice Department against this book, which is coming out next week, and apparently has been successful, spectacularly successful, in making a book that nobody wanted to read, and certainly nobody wanted to buy. It's now number one on the Amazon bestseller list. So, hey, good going there, Donald. I mean, that is amazing. And of course, you know, the chances of him actually getting a federal judge to engage in prior restraint, I would say, would be close to slim or none. And in any case, it's just kind of the reality check. If John Bolton wants to sit down in front of a microphone like the one we're using right now and just read the book, or go to Congress and just simply read the book as a script, he can do it. There's a thing about information. It wants to be free. It's going to get out there. So apparently the only thing that Donald Trump has succeeded in doing is taking a book that everybody thought was completely irrelevant and self-serving, and it's made it the number one bestseller in the country. So we have that. Meanwhile, we have more numbers out here. There is, I'm always hesitant to cite a specific poll because there are always outliers and you can read too much into it. But this new Reuters Ipsos poll, I think, is part of a pattern here, showing that Joe Biden has opened up a 13-point advantage as Trump popularity drops to 7-month low. Keep in mind, these are registered voters, not likely voters. One caveat. Number two, this is national, not swing state. But these are big numbers, including the fact that you now have 57% of U.S. adults disapproving of Trump's performance in office. His approval rating is down to 38%. In the head-to-head, 48% say they'll back Biden, 35% they would support Trump. So what you're seeing is a series of polls all lining up to suggest that the disapproval rating for the president has really kicked up. And I mentioned this in the newsletter today. It's kind of hard to come back. Not impossible, not at all impossible, but more and more difficult to come back when your disapproval rating is in the high 50s. Okay, so before we get into today's discussion, Tucker Carlson spent some time attacking some conservative Republicans, interestingly enough, for failing to fall into line to go after Google. There was a misleading report yesterday by NBC that Google had demonetized a couple of websites, including The Federalist. They quickly came out and said, no, we had threatened to do stuff, but we are not demonetizing The Federalist. This is not digital fascism. We are not censoring anybody. But that didn't stop Tucker Carlson from going on a monologue, attacking Republicans for not using the power of the federal government more aggressively to go after Google, and have a specific fact check at the end.
And now it is happening. Google is acting directly to shape what people can say and what they're allowed to speak. It's a direct effort to stifle free speech. All of that is even truer today. So why hasn't the Congress done anything about this? Well, we'd love to ask Senator Mike Lee of Utah. We invited him on the show tonight. He would not come. We've invited him before. He would not come then. Why do we ask him? Because Lee chairs the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee. He is the man who could do something to protect you from Google. But Lee has not bothered to do that. Instead, Mike Lee repeatedly has taken the side of the big tech companies over your constitutional rights, the constitutional rights Mike Lee is sworn to uphold and protect, but refuses to. So the question is, why is Mike Lee still sitting in the United States Senate? He should not be in the Senate, that is for sure. We are hoping Mike Lee is soundly defeated in his next primary by someone who cares about the Constitution, and more to the point, about protecting Americans from the actual threats they face. We are fervently rooting for that day. We will celebrate it when it happens. We trust it will. So how about House Republicans? Well, this spring, Congressman Doug Collins, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, and Jim Sensenbrenner, the ranking member of the Antitrust Subcommittee, released a letter defending Google and the other tech monopolies from scrutiny. They attacked any investigation of the tech companies that might have, quote, preconceived conclusions that large tech companies are inherently bad or must be broken up. They actually wrote that. Who is paying these guys? And more to the point, whose side are they on? Again, let us hope for a vigorous primary challenge to these two and any who share this view.
All right, I'm not going to get into the merits of all of this, except to say that Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner is my local congressman, and he's not running for re-election. He can't be ousted in a primary election. I think we probably would have taken Tucker about 5 minutes on Google to have determined that. And I suppose it's worth also mentioning that Tucker decided to go on this rant against Jim Sensenbrenner the day after his wife died. So keep it classy there, Tucker. Okay, we're going to have an interesting discussion here today. We are joined by Camille Foster. Did I pronounce your name right? Because I don't want to get it wrong.
That is exactly right, Charlie. How are you?
I am great. You are the co-host of the legendary podcast, The Fifth Column, and one of the founders of Freethink Media. So it is great to talk with you. And I will tell you that in answer to the question, the only person on earth who is going to be the answer will be Camille Foster, who appeared within a week on the Federalist podcast and the Bulwark podcast. this is a first, and I'm thinking it's likely to be, I mean, this will be like, you know, asteroid, you know, hitting second base at Yankee Stadium. I think you're going to have this distinction for some time.
Okay.
So, anyway, so
I hope it's an honorable distinction.
It's a distinction. So before we get into all of this stuff, I don't think you and I have met, but we've worked together through your association with Freethink. And
that's
I know
true.
That you worked on the movie about the Honor Flight, which is still one of the, one of the good things, one of my good memories I look back on. And you worked with Dan Hayes and company in putting mm-hmm. together an absolutely fabulous movie about this effort here in southeastern Wisconsin to send World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. And I just got to tell you, guys did such a good job on that movie.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie. And you did so much to help make that project possible and make it the success that it was. And participating in the production of that film over the course of a couple of years, actually, is something that was just deeply profound for me and helped to change my perspective on the country. I developed a deeper appreciation for it, having an opportunity to interact with all those genuinely, and I use the word here with no exaggeration at all or embellishment, heroes. It was just a really remarkable accomplishment. And I would certainly encourage people to find Honor Flight and watch it, not because of me, but because it, I think, gives them a real opportunity to speak for themselves.
Yeah, and part of the reason I didn't want to mention it is it feels like from the kind of a different world. This is the story is how everybody came together, across party lines, ideological lines, every possible division to come together, recognizing that the clock was running, that these World War II veterans were dying at a tremendous rate every single day. So many of them had not been able to live long enough to be able to go on this. So there was a real sense of urgency. And the way people came together to raise money for this, I know there are honor flights all around the country, but this movie focused on Stars and Stripes Honor Flight, an amazing group of people who I don't know how many in the end, how many flights they sent. But I remember standing with your partner, Dan Hayes. We were standing at the Iwo Jima Memorial with somebody, surrounded by these World War II veterans, many of whom were in their late 80s or early 90s. And I just remember, I know that he was thinking at that moment, this would make an absolutely fabulous movie. We have to tell this story before it's too late. So anyway, so thank you so much. Okay, so we are in strange times. And I want to talk to you about what's going on with the fight over racism, the fight over Black Lives Matter. We have a debate about everything from monuments to kneeling to whether or not we really want to have a conversation or whether we want to have an apology tour. So I emailed you, or actually our producer, Jim Swift, emailed you and said, what did you want to talk about? And you answered, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that you want to talk about the problem of anti-racism, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I wrote back saying, whoa, so anti-racism is the problem now, Camille? Anti-racism is the problem.
It's a okay. problem. It's a problem.
Okay. So tell me what the problem is.
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, I think we live in a profoundly complicated and in many ways distressing moment, obviously, for since the beginning of the year in various ways. Increasingly, we were dealing with the pandemic that's left most of us trapped in our homes in various ways and all sorts of other things, all these restrictions that we're learning to live with and these curtailments of our normal lives. And suddenly, over the course of a couple of weeks, really, we find ourselves in the midst of a really profound social upheaval as well, one that has race at its center, but began ostensibly as something related to criminal justice reform and the need for, you know, more transparency and accountability in policing, that is really snowballed into something else, like a movement unlike anything I've ever really seen. And I think for the average American who hasn't been paying attention, you know, this looks like, well, you know, the conversation here is a very good thing. We are talking about systemic injustice and perhaps overlooked issues and trying to address this unique problem that is facing Black people. But for some of us, and, you know, it's hard to describe who those some of us are, but certainly I'm among that number. I'd say folks like John McWhorter, who wrote a fabulous piece called The Anti-Racism, Our Flawed New Religion. Some of us have seen a trend really emerge over the course of the last couple of years, and it's a trend towards a new way of thinking about what racism is. And specifically about centering systematic racism as a problem that needs to be addressed. And it's a well-intentioned project to try to redress historic injustices. But I think it is a deeply flawed project that has a lot to do with the reasons why so many of the problems that we're currently trying to discuss seem so intractable. And I think has a lot to do with the cultural and social upheaval as well that we're experiencing.
When you say that it's deeply flawed, though, are you saying that the awakening to the reality and the depth of racism that this is not a worthy project? I mean, are we talking about the project itself or the more extreme reactions to it? Because I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I think there is a moment here, and a lot of us on the right, I think, were in denial about the extent of it. I think that we felt that maybe we started rolling our eyes because, you know, people played the race card for too many years. We thought that, well, with the election of Barack Obama, right, the passage of these various pieces of legislation, that problem has solved and we need to move past it. And now there's a recognition, okay, you know, perhaps there was something that ran deeper. And obviously these videotapes of the police are really wrenching the nation's conscience. And doesn't the nation's conscience need to be wrenched?
Well, I think the issue here is that while racism is obviously objectionable, and it is definitely true that so much of our nation's history is bound up in racism and a history of, sort of slavery and segregation and various other injustices, historic injustices, it is possible to overstate our concerns. It is always possible, if generally overlooked, that overconcern can have real tangible consequences. And I think we find ourselves in a moment where exaggeration and hyperbole are probably winning the day. To the extent people believe that there is a unique, persistent, you know, genocide being perpetrated against like African Americans by the police in the United States of America, like that is a misguided belief. It isn't informed by the data. And I say that as someone who believes in and is deeply committed to criminal justice reform and believes that we need greater transparency in policing and more accountability. And quite frankly, that police departments and the criminal justice system more broadly needs a smaller mandate. But I don't think it's helpful, for example, when you have, you know, sitting Congress senators in the United States like Cory Booker suggesting that African-American men, and this is a quote, mostly unarmed, are being murdered by police officers and there's no way of holding them accountable. This is not true that there is a glut of things like that happening. And to the extent that those things do happen, egregious civilian deaths that happen unnecessarily involving police officers, It happens to Black people and white people, not in equal proportion, but in proportions that are explicable for reasons that have nothing to do with racial bias, be it implicit or explicit.
I appreciate the precision of the language here, but this is important here to not exaggerate, to not engage in hyperbole. And clearly, if you're starting to use words like genocide, you are overstating it. But there's also a price, isn't there, for understating it, the looking the other way. And again, Cory Booker obviously was out there. But when he's making the point about the lack of accountability, he is describing a situation where you do have an extraordinary pattern. It's real, of young Black men who are killed in police custody. Guys who look like me, this is not happening on a regular basis. And there is the concept of qualified immunity, which I know you've addressed in the past, which makes it extremely hard to hold police accountable. And until the era of the videotape, let's be honest, cops were able to get away with pretty much everything. And I think that's kind of the shock, isn't it? That we're now seeing videotapes that are showing us something that was probably going on for a long time, but we can't take our eyes away from it, right? So there is a real problem. So how do you get that balance of not overstating it, but also catching up with the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years of under-addressing it?
Well, I think the response to the George Floyd video, as with the response to various other videos that reached national prominence, suggests that there is an appetite to do something about perceived injustices in policing. And there has been a trend towards criminal justice reform in various sorts, both on the right and the left, importantly, since the early 2000s. And I think that's a very good thing. I certainly think more should happen. But I don't think we're running any risk, quite frankly, of understating the problem. And I do think that we have sort of a selective concern about these killings. And it's frequently the case that when white people die under similar circumstances, similarly questionable circumstances, be they armed or unarmed, those killings generally get underreported. And it creates the perception of a problem that is unique to Black people, which I think if you misdiagnose the problem, the likelihood that you come up with the wrong kind of solutions is very high. You know, if the presumption here is that what we need is racial bias training or more Black cops on the force, then you end up with Baltimore. And I can tell you that Baltimore is hardly a picture of police professionalism, where there isn't abuses of power and there isn't corruption and there aren't people who get hurt and even killed unnecessarily by police officers.
Baltimore is certainly not an example for anyone. Part of the problem, though, is there are these alternative narratives out there. We do live in these alternative reality worlds where, if you get all of your news from Fox News or The Federalist, you're not going to see this as a particular problem. I mean, The Federalist is a publication that, I know you know this, up until 2017 used to tag its stories Black crime, cited, 4chan, whitewashed Charlottesville. That there's a different version of all of this. So, part of this is whether or not we are going to find some sort of unified way of addressing this. So that I'm a little unclear. Do you think that the George Floyd killing was not an example of racism?
I think, well, two things briefly, since you mentioned The Federalist. I know Ben Dominich. He's a friend. I know that The Federalist tends to publish things that I sometimes disagree with, and sometimes they publish things I agree with. But I'd say that Ben, in particular, has a long history of talking about the need for police reform and criminal justice reform. So I'd give him credit for that. And he's often wanted to talk to me about that on his platform. So I'm grateful for that opportunity. Specifically with respect to George Floyd.
Well, I don't want to get into a debate about this, but here's a guy that in Charlottesville, after the white racist ran his car, killed one of the protesters, he actually tweeted out a link from 4chan suggesting that the driver of that car was Black.
I can't speak to that, but that's certainly not true.
Well, let's just leave that aside. So, but on this issue, and I want to get to the monuments and the Maoism, because understand that I have been writing about extreme leftist intolerance for years, and I'm trying to figure out whether there's a center that can say, you know what, we need to confront what's been happening on the right. You know, we can talk about Antifa, but we also need to talk about the Boogaloos. We can talk about Black Lives Matter. We have to also talk about what's going on with the alt-right, what's been happening with Charlottesville, the way in which identity politics has really kind of infected the bloodstream, which is not to deny. So, you know, when I hear the complaints about intolerant Maoists, what they're doing in the media, I get that, because I've lived that. But also, I guess part of what I try to do is I can't affect the left. They don't care what I think about anything. it's looking at my fellow conservatives and going, wow, we have been we've had our heads down for a long time, and we've bought memes and we've used language and we have put out whistles and foghorns for a long time that look pretty awful at the moment.
Well, let me take the George Floyd question that you'd asked a moment ago, because I think it's an important point. I've yet to watch that video. Quite frankly, I've seen a lot of police involved civilian death videos, and I just have a hard time with it. I've seen clips of it. I've read the reports, and what I can tell you is this: it certainly seems as though the police have some culpability in George Floyd's death. At a minimum, they should have been more attentive to a citizen who was in their custody, who was complaining and saying that he was having difficulty breathing. That is the minimum. So this needs to be thoroughly investigated. And to the extent wrongdoing has occurred, people need to be prosecuted and punished appropriately. That said, I look at this case and I look at the facts surrounding it, and there I've seen absolutely no evidence whatsoever brought to the fore that suggests that what happened here to George Floyd couldn't have happened to him if he were a white man. And I think it's important to note when we're using assertions and assumptions to substantiate our pre-existing beliefs about the role of race in policing, and to make something essentially representative of, you know, a broad continuum of racial injustice that stretches from the Middle Passage all the way up to Emmett Till, down to Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. I think that's a dangerous bit of conflation, and I don't think that actually puts us on a path to seriously understanding what's happening, because the problem may not be as specific as people imagine, but it might be systemic in the sense that we have a broader problem with policing that actually needs to be addressed in a substantive way.
You know, I understand that this point, particularly, I mean, it's still a sore spot with me about what happened in Ferguson, where you still have people doing the, you know, hands up, don't shoot. When in fact, the Justice Department, very thorough investigation, determined that that narrative did not take place. That did not happen.
That's right.
And yet it got stuck. There were, of course, other reports that would suggest that this police department had a long track record of racism, but not in that particular case. So, you know, your point about separating the individual incident from this larger narrative is very, very important. But I got to tell you, you have a different perspective than I do. I mean, it's kind of weird. You know, you're an African-American man and I'm a white conservative sitting in the Midwest, but I can't look at the George Floyd thing without seeing a white cop with his knee on a black man's neck. So I can't not see that in that particular way. And there's been stories. I mean,
there have been stories ignored during the same period, right? There have been stories of white people who died unarmed this year within the same week. There was a white man in Potomac, Maryland, who was shot and killed while sleeping in his bed, reportedly, by police officers who came into his home with a warrant. No one knows his name. He died the day before Breonna Taylor. The day before, there was a white woman who was killed coming home from work the other day during a traffic stop. So far as we know at the moment, she was unarmed. These things happen, and they happen with a regularity that would alarm Americans if they would actually pay attention to it as a broader issue, as opposed to pretending that it's a specific.
Okay, well, that's true, and they ought to be alarmed about it. So there's a larger problem of police violence, but doesn't negate the subset of the problem of police violence aimed at African Americans. They're not mutually exclusive, right?
No, the two aren't mutually exclusive. That's exactly right. But I do think our capacity to overstate them, and quite frankly, the fact that we have overstated them in recent years, and in many cases found ourselves, you know, elevating particular cases to the national spotlight, only to discover later, as you just pointed out, that certain facts were wrong. That has consequences. And I think that actually has a number of consequences that go underappreciated. It could stir up racial tensions. It can distract us from actually having meaningful conversations about the kind of reforms that we need. And I think that we have to be on guard against our priors. And you mentioned a moment ago, you know, our respective vantage points and our race. And I will say that, you know, one of my biggest concerns about the current moment and about anti-racism is the degree to which anti-racism almost requires us. It almost obliges us to think about people in essentialist terms and to presume that our experiences are uniform on account of our races, to presume that our innate characteristics suggests that we embody privilege or embody disadvantage. And I just think that is it's obviously dishonest. It's obviously wrong. It's provably false. It's an assertion that people presume, and it is part of a system of thinking about the world that I think actually has a lot of pernicious consequences. And unfortunately, it's ensnared, I think, a lot of well-intentioned people who want to do good in the world. My goal is equal protection under the law. I think that is the shining bright star. That's the lodestone that America is supposed to be sort of granting to us, that there is a law, that the government itself is restrained by the law, and that it protects our rights uniformly. That is a sufficiently lofty aspiration without presuming that what the government ought to be doing is adjudicating all of the evils in men's heart, and that the government has the capacity, for example, to extinguish racism or to redress all historic injustice. It can't do that any more than it can remedy poverty finally and forever without having really nasty consequences. And I think that's just a really important distinction for people to appreciate.
Well, I agree with you. And by the way, I do think this identity politics often is reductionist, which is you reduce someone simply to their race, to their gender. And, you know, it's interesting that we have at the same time people saying we need to have a conversation about race, at the same time that if I have a heterodox opinion expressed, I'm told you're a white male, you should shut up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to hear, as if I am now reduced to all of that. And you're also right, and this is, I think, a very fundamentally conservative insight, that government does not have the power to change human nature. It cannot eradicate racial thoughts. But that doesn't mean it ought not to try, right? Mm. It doesn't mean that it ought not to make sure that we have equal justice, that we make sure that we haven't stacked the deck, right?
Well, I think... It depends on what we mean by try.
It means that there's a difference between there may not be a solution, but that doesn't mean there's a remedy. There's not a remedy, that we can't make things better in terms of just even the language that we use.
I would generally agree with that. But I would also warn that, you know, our best intentions infused with the power of the state and turned into policy can often have really dastardly, unintentionally bad outcomes. And I think, you know, in the pursuit of racial justice, I think we've actually made tremendous progress in this country over the course of the last 100 years or so. I think growing up in the 1980s, there was, you know, a very different perspective on race that was preeminent. Most of the dominant celebrities that I was familiar with, or at least many of them, were black and brown people, so to speak. Some of these names are a bit more nefarious now, but your Michael Jacksons, your Mike Tysons, and your Michael Jordans, you know, all black people. Your Bill Cosbys, who before he was, you know, pernicious sex predator, was America's father. The notion that what we need to do now in order to improve ourselves is to revert to something that looks a bit too much like the sort of tribal identity first thinking that was dominant in the 1950s and the 1960s just actually seems completely misguided to me.
No, I understand that. But on the other hand, one of the things that government can do is appeal to the better angels of our nature, as opposed to necessarily think that they can impose that. Okay, now you tweeted, I want people to discuss this. There's a piece that's gotten a lot of discussion by Matt Taibbi, if I pronounce his name correctly, formerly of Rolling Stone, now has his own column. And it is an incredibly provocative piece. And I know that you're familiar with it. Basically says the news media is destroying itself. And he gets attacked from both right and left. So I appreciate that. And let me read you two paragraphs of this story, because I know you're familiar with it. He starts off by talking about Trump, and then he talks about some of the things that are happening in the media. Our president, Donald Trump, is a clown who makes a great reality show villain, but is uniquely toolless as the leader of a superpower nation. Watching him try to think through two society imperiling crises is like waiting for a gerbil to solve Fermat's theorem. Calls to dominate marchers and ad-lib speculations about Floyd's great day looking down from heaven at Trump's crisis management and new unemployment numbers, only 21 million out of work, were pure gasoline at a tinderbox moment. The man seems determined to talk us into civil war. Now he makes the turn. But police violence and Trump's daily assaults on the presidential competence standard are only part of the disaster. On the other side of the political aisle, among self-described liberals, we're watching an intellectual revolution. It feels liberating to say after years of tiptoeing around the fact, but the American left has lost its mind. It's become a cowardly mob of upper-class social media addicts, Twitter Robespierres, who move from discipline to discipline, torching reputations and jobs with breathtaking casualness. And I think this is something that you've been focusing on. And one of the things that strikes me, and I'd written about this, we were talking about things on university campuses, some of this intellectual intolerance that used to be confined to the tonier reaches of elite universities has now really seeped out into the general society, and we're seeing it play out in the media. And this is also a disturbing thing. And I do think that it's really incumbent on center-left actual small L liberals to understand that you can support social justice without going along with this kind of sort of quasi-Maoist Twitter Robespierre culture.
I don't even know. I can't improve on that. That's absolutely right. And I think that piece really is, the entire piece is pretty indispensable for helping to capture what's happening in this moment. And a number of people I know personally, Li Fang, who's at The Intercept, he's a very good reporter, left of center, but someone who I know and respect. Barry Weiss is another friend. I think both of them get name checked in that post. And both of them have been subject to really, at certain point, I think it's fair to use the word frightening, really frightening social media mobs and really hostile interactions, almost systematically hostile interactions with their coworkers in their newsrooms. And I wouldn't, you know, betray anyone's confidence. I think now I'm just echoing things that are sort of obviously true to anyone who's looking at the circumstance. And the kind of sort of ideological purity tests that are being deployed in newsrooms, the goal to turn newsrooms into sort of morally affirmative organizations that are pushing a particular set of values with a particular kind of confidence, as opposed to, you know, trying to at least perform objectivity as a sort of professional responsibility. I think it's an important development that we ought to be aware of, and it could have really profound consequences for our society more broadly.
I think it will have profound consequences, including for the media. And of course, people are familiar with what happened at the New York Times, where whatever you think about Tom Cotton's op-ed, which I disagreed with thoroughly.
Agreed.
The fact that it eventually resulted in the resignation, quote, firings of, you know, top editors of the New York Times, that the staff of the New York Times objected to ideas being published in their paper, and conflating. And this, I think, is one of the most dangerous things, the conflating, the confusion of language with violence. Mm-hmm. Look, language is language. Violence is violence. And once you start confusing the two of them, you open the door to censorship, to, you know, criminalizing certain things. You know, I can express an opinion you don't like, but when you start saying, well, now, you know, your opinion makes me feel unsafe, it's the equivalent mm-hmm. of violence. We've rejected the entire traditional liberal belief system about free inquiry.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's right. And
so, yeah, I mean, I was going to read you from Matt Tate. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead. The appetite.
I was just going to say that, and I think this is something you could speak to pretty capably, but the appetite for censorship, both on the left and the right these days, is something that I find particularly distressing. You know, the left is worried about words as violence. The right is constantly beating the drum about social media censorship, and I using air quotes, you can't see it, and wants to institute legislative fixes for this. And both of those trends disturb me pretty profoundly.
Yeah, and I think they ought to disturb a lot of Americans. So let me just read you from Matt Taibbi's piece, because I think he really lays it out here. He said, the leaders of this new movement are replacing traditional liberal beliefs about tolerance, free inquiry, and even racial harmony with ideas so toxic and unattractive that they eschew debate, moving straight to shaming, threats, and intimidation. They're counting on the guilt-ridden, self-flagellating nature of traditional American progressives who will not stand up for themselves and will walk to the razor voluntarily. Look, I understand some of the listeners of this podcast aren't going to like this, but if you think there's not going to be a backlash to this, if you don't think this can be weaponized against you, if you think that there's this great kumbaya moment of the nation coming together that doesn't need to push back against this, I think you're making a huge mistake. Okay, so I want to ask you about, let's get more nitty into the issues of the things that are happening. Where do you come down on the taking down monuments, naming of military bases and things like that?
Well, I don't have a problem with communities deciding that that's something that they want to do. I perhaps bristle a little bit at, you know, mobs getting together and, you know, performatively destroying these things on their own. That I find a bit disturbing. But I do think that there are important things that people ought to consider about, you know, the history of these monuments and about their actual role in our society. And I don't know who folks are trying to protect. You know, I grew up watching the Dukes of Hazzard, you know, just some good old boys who never meaning no harm. And they drove the General Lee and there was a Confederate flag on top of the car. And the truth is that I just wanted the Duke brothers to win. And I, you know, am lusting after Daisy Duke. And I never thought to myself for a moment, God, if only the South had won. You know, it just never happened. And I'm currently in Front Royal, Virginia. I drive down Stonewall Jackson Highway every day and it doesn't fill me with any sort of dread. And I've never thought to myself, God, I wish they would change the name to Martin Luther King Highway. I do think that there's a bit of performance here. And I look at it in connection, or at least in juxtaposed against the assemblage of congresspersons who were kneeling in the Capitol, who had these kente cloth draped around their necks. And, you know, kente cloth is from Ghana. It was something that was developed by the Ashanti. And the Ashanti are a tribe who participated in the slave trade. They would capture slaves and sell them to Europeans. There was not a period when Europeans were trouncing around the, quote, dark continent, looking for Black people that they could capture in nets and then bringing them back to the U.S. They had partners on the other side of the Atlantic. And, you know, we're able to separate the kente cloth from that tradition, and at least have not yet arrived at a place where we need to cancel it. But we find ourselves, you know, excavating the letters of famed authors and finding in them repugnant ideas and saying to ourselves, well, maybe this person shouldn't be read anymore. And maybe this statue needs to come down. And I find that disturbing. I find it disturbing that people are coming for Thomas Jefferson at this point. That seems weird to me. And again, that seems like an overcorrection for perhaps a real problem.
I agree with you. And I think it's an interesting historical footnote that the kente cloth actually has that background. I'm guessing nobody who was wearing it knew that. But
presumably,
if somebody up in Wisconsin or in Michigan or Minnesota who's waving a Confederate flag, they know what that stands for. They're making a statement.
Maybe the statement that they may be.
It's like he kind of got a gotcha here. Whereas the people waving the Confederate flag, they have a real message, don't they?
I don't know about that. I think that the message that most people, again, when I grew up with the Confederate flag in the Dukes of Hazzard, it was a symbol of rebellion, but it wasn't a celebration of slavery. And I do think that the Confederate flag, and if you look at polling on this, even amongst Black people who live in the South, has largely become a symbol of Southern pride. And things do undergo changes in meaning. There is a dastardly word that I won't use on your program that right. has taken on a very familial meaning among certain people, but has a dark history. And these things happen. And I think it's a mistake for us to pretend that we can always discern what's in other people's heart. Sometimes it's just a thumb in your eye. Sometimes it's, I know what you think this is. I don't care. I'm going to use it anyways because it's mine. And oftentimes, instead of fighting about the things that are important, like police violence, we're fighting about whether or not you kneeling is appropriate. And I think that is the real problem.
Okay, let's talk about kneeling. This is interesting in terms of changing meaning, because before Colin Kaepernick, I always thought of kneeling as an act of respect. It's something you did in church. It's something you did at a gravesite. And then, of course, it became politicized. It became very tribalized. The president of the United States, drew the line. These sons of bitches needed to be, kicked off the teams. And now, in retrospect, though, as we've seen this explosion, which includes incidents of violence, it's interesting hearing people say, look, we need to make a real distinction between respectful, nonviolent protests and this kind of violent, extreme protest that we've been talking about. Well, what about kneeling? Isn't that a form of respectful protest in retrospect?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything particularly pernicious about kneeling. I do think that particular debate is one that we sort of sanitize and we take out a lot of the historical context that's important. I mean, part of the reason why Colin Kaepernick became such a figure of hate on the right wasn't because he was saying, Black Lives Matter and we should really look into criminal justice reform. And I'm going to take a knee just to bring attention to this. He was doing a lot of other inflammatory things too. I'm sure you remember the pigs on his socks, the Fidel Castro t-shirts, the repeated comments about how, deeply racist America is, not merely was, is lack of appreciation for July 4th, for example. Like, these are sentiments that are deeply unpopular. And once you conflate all of that with the broader message that he was ostensibly trying to promote, one that was about criminal justice reform, the fact that he was engaged in all of this other behavior and the fact that much of his rhetoric was often peppered with things that, again, were a bit hysterical, it's not hard to see how that debate devolved into something else.
Well, that's how it did devolve. However, he was not the only one who did it. And so at a certain point, this didn't become about Colin Kaepernick. It was a lot of people, and they got the same thing. So, for example, Dale Earnhardt Jr. tweeted out at one point, NASCAR guy, tweeted out, all Americans are granted rights to peaceful protests. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. JFK. And since we've been talking about it, the Federalist ran a big piece, Why Dale Earnhardt is Wrong. And here's what they wrote. You got it all wrong, Dale. Their protest, the protest of all of these players who are doing this, which focuses on the United States as represented by the flag and the national anthem, dishonors every American, especially if they're white. Why would that be especially if they're white? How did we get to that point?
Yeah, that's certainly not a sentiment that I would agree with, and I don't know the context for that quote. I mean, it seems pretty obnoxious.
The next sentence is, these protests should outrage all law-abiding Americans because it collectively and individually makes them guilty for something they have not done. Earnhardt's quotation of John F. Kennedy is so inappropriate, it's laughable, and blah, 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 et cetera.
Yeah.
So, okay, I guess I wonder whether or not there's a reevaluation of the kneeling in light of what we've gone through.
And I'd be fine to, you know, again, as I said, I don't have any objection to kneeling. I think it is absolutely an exercise of speech. I think it's also the case that, you know, it's the prerogative of an employer whether they would like for you to do something on their time. So that's a separate conversation. Well, but I'm fine with that. But I do think that it's important to just be to be honest about how things, you know, ostensibly this began as a Colin Kaepernick's protest began as an effort to try to bring awareness to the problem of police, you know, injuring Black people in particular. And Colin has done some things that I think are laudable, like encouraging people to have a better understanding of their rights. But at the same time, I think Colin actually helped to inflame tensions around those issues and to play into essentially Donald Trump's hands, who once he had the opportunity to, you know, Colin is essentially saying somewhat hysterical things, and Donald Trump wants to, you know, kick his ass or something like that because he's disrespecting the flag. And again, in between all of this, criminal justice reform is not happening as a result of this ridiculous feud about something other than what is ostensibly important to everyone.
Well, and I think that, and that's the key thing. So just on the monument thing, going back, I completely agree with you on, you know, if we start pulling down Winston Churchill and Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson and George Washington, well, then we are never going to be dealing with any of these problems. We've all collectively lost our minds. On the other hand, there are distinctions I think that can be made with people like, you know, for example, how would you feel about a monument for Nathan Bedford Forrest? Because I mean, there were controversies about him, you know, the Confederate general who actually was one of the founders of the KKK. Now, mm-hmm. Is that performative to take that down? Or is that like, yeah, you know what? We really just don't need that.
Yeah. I mean, I think a community coming together and deciding that they don't want something like that anymore is, you know, totally fine. And I think respectable and perhaps even laudable. I remember Byrd Stadium at the University of Maryland, where I did my undergraduate. There was a campaign sometime after I left to rename Byrd Stadium because the booster for the campus, I don't know who Mr. Byrd was apparently some sort of racist and had said and done some disreputable things. You know, I was on campus for more than 4 years because I had an unconventional collegiate experience. And Byrd Stadium never bothered me. It's a place that I have a lot of great memories in. And it's worth remembering that, you know, history is interesting and fungible, and it's interpreted in ways that are often pretty subjective. And the way that we relate to a statue, sometimes it's a symbol, sometimes it's about celebration and remembrance and honor. Sometimes it's about sainthood and, you know, presenting a fiction, and other times it's just a block of rock, you know, right. It's just an ornament and a decoration. And I think confusing the kind of ceremonial pursuit of grievance alleviation and redress and the redress of historical injury in a performative way, like, we should just know that. What are we really we should be aware of whether or not we're actually accomplishing something profound here. I don't know that self-flagellation is particularly profound in the broad scope of things. You know, during these protests, Chicago has become a war zone. During these protests, various cities have experienced upticks in violence, not involving the police, but involving citizens. And the people who are suffering the most, not that this is a unique concern of mine, because anyone dying is a concern for me, but the people who are suffering the most are young Black men. And I think that there is something very telling about that, juxtaposed against the stated concern that people have. If we're really concerned about the things that we say we're concerned about, then I think it's appropriate for us to take stock of the way that we're approaching these issues and the places where we're placing our priorities. And I think that, you know, a debate about whether or not Black should be capitalized in the New York Times, like, that doesn't seem terribly valuable to me. And I think it might actually be pernicious.
You actually, I think you had a tweet, I don't have it right in front of me right now, where you ran down the death toll in places like Chicago, and then juxtaposed to this idea of, like, really, we're really going to be abolishing the police. This again is where the debates always run off the run off the rails, where we go from being concerned about injustice to talking about defunding the police, whatever that means at any given moment, or abolishing the police, or doing all of these things. These are not ideas that have much traction, although they're noisy, aren't they? And I guess that's one of the things I'm trying to do is to say, okay, you know, in terms of defunding police, that's the Twitter extreme position out there, abolishing police. It is supported by no one within the mainstream Democratic Party. So, what when we're talking, there's a tendency for people on the left to look at the right and take the most extreme irresponsible voice and say, that is what it means to be a conservative, a right winger, or a Republican, or a libertarian.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's a tendency on the right to take the most extreme, loudest, craziest, radical on the left and say, this is what happens if you vote for any Democrat. I mean, you know, Joe Biden is not out there saying abolish the police.
Right.
You know, any more than libertarians are saying, yeah, keep stomping people on their faces because, you know, we stand by the cops. Right. I mean, so it is sometimes it feels like we are living in this cartoon world where we don't actually talk to one another. We debate cartoon images of one another.
That's right. Yeah. Caricatures, bad faith. I think those are some of the most fundamental tools deployed in contemporary politics. And perhaps they've always been the most fundamental tools of politics. I am a firm believer in the axiom that politics ruins everything, in much the same way race ruins everything. So, you know, what makes this country great, I've always said, you know, is not the sort of composition of our government. It's not the various things that the government is doing. It's certainly not the government. It's the people, and it's the culture. And to the extent we still value, you know, freedom, to the extent we still value the classical liberal ideals that are embodied in the Constitution, I think that's a great thing. But if that culture goes bad for whatever reason, then, you know, it fails to be great, whatever the government looks like, whoever's in office, whatever policies are instituted.
Boy, that's a great way to finish. That was very, very eloquent. You notice how we all get along with one another until we start talking about politics. We're this fundamentally decent, reasonable people until we talk about politics, and then we all lose our freaking minds. So you are absolutely right. Camille Foster, thank you so much. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I really am grateful for all of your time today.
No, thank you, Charlie. I appreciate it. And again, thank you for everything that you've done for veterans and for, you know, being a voice for reason. I appreciate that.
Well, we try occasionally. And well, thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.